Okay, I don't have a gavel in front of me, but we'll call this meeting to order. Somebody want to move to approve the minutes quick, as long as we already have a quorum? Representative Hawes moves, is there any discussion? Otherwise, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, carried.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to announce that this is, again, the last committee hearing before St. Patrick's Day. And I want to welcome all the committee members here for being out Friday by drinking your beautiful green Shamrock Shake, which we do every year in this committee. So again, here's to all of you and Representative Hamer. That's true. It wasn't me, I swear.
Thank you, Representative West. Representative Paymar, House File 2906.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'd like to move House File 2906. That be recommended to pass and return to finance with a recommendation for re-referral to the criminal register.
Okay. Representative Paymar, I understand you have some author's amendments.
I do, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move first the A-19 amendment.
Representative Paymar moves the A-19 amendments. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Carried.
Thank you. Then I'd like to move the A-20 amendment.
Representative Paymar moves A-20. Is there any discussion on A-20? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the A-20 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just open up by just saying that this is a dangerous dog bill. The legislation strengthens existing law by giving animal control authorities the tools they need to better protect the public from dog bites and dog attacks. Professionals in the field of animal care and control agree that with very few exceptions, dogs are not born dangerous, but they are created by irresponsible ownership. Minnesota's existing law defines a dangerous dog and a potentially dangerous dog by outlining how a dog acts without provocation and the types of threats, injuries, and damage the dog might inflict. Existing language also stipulates that a designated dangerous dog must be registered with the local animal control authority upon proof that the dog has proper enclosure, the owner has been issued a surety bond, has paid a fee, and has a microchip identification implanted in the dangerous dog. The bill addresses repeat offenders and the culpability of dog owners who endanger the public. It also clarifies language, defines provocation, requires sterilization of dangerous dogs, and increases penalties for those who create dangerous dogs through irresponsible actions. Mr. Chair, we had a fiscal note that we should have. I can't find it in mind right now. But here it is. There'd be minimal cost according to the fiscal note, and probably even less cost since we amended in the last committee the felony provision out of here. So, I don't know, Mr. Carter, if you want to.
Mr. Carter, you want to comment?
If Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar is right, the fiscal note is showing no impact right now to the state of Minnesota. Fiscal impact.
And the and Mr. Chair, the just so you know what the amendments did, these were amendments that were added in the Senate Ag Committee, and this deals with the prohibition of ever owning a dog again, and this provides a little bit more leeway that allows the dog owner who had been convicted of offenses that you see in Section 13 to basically appeal that prohibition so they might own a dog. What else? I think that's about it. I'd answer any questions that that you have. I think that this is the right direction to move. I know that Senator Lesch feels strongly about this issue and had a, and brought forth a bill. I hope that this assuages some of his concerns that we're getting to really the crux of the problem, and that is the owners of dangerous dogs. We do have a provision in here that also speaks to the, if you, to some of the issues that Representative Lesch had raised about making sure that the owner of a dangerous dog completes a dog training or dog handling courses if they wanted to own a dog after the 3-year prohibition. I have Forbes with me if you have any specific questions about the bill, and I'll stand for questions.
Okay, I'll go to discussion now and see if it relates in forcing Mr. Forbes to testify, which it may. Representative Lesch?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Tamar, you had talked about the appeal of the prohibition. Do you know, compared to, for example, when someone is excluded from owning a firearm due to a conviction for domestic abuse or something else, is there a similar appeal process that they follow? And so, if you know, how often is someone's prohibition overturned in those cases?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that there is an appeal process for possessing a gun if you've been convicted of a domestic assault.
Mr. Chair.
You may proceed, Representative Lesch.
Thank you. And I know you're enjoying your shamrock shake there, Mr. Chair, so I apologize.
Yeah, you did catch me on that one.
But I guess that is one of my concerns. Now, I know the direction that we have to go on this, and obviously I do have some concerns. And just to correct you, Representative Tamar, I actually didn't have a bill. I never dropped a bill and hopped on this because I so enjoyed working with your advocates, and they were so nice to work with. With a couple of exceptions who were kind of nutty, but for the most part, it was good to work with people. I think we have a common goal. I did want classes and the insurance increase. I still think the insurance is too low for a child who is mauled and has to go through lifelong medical treatment for one of these dangerous dogs. My question for you, Mr. Representative Tamar, is it true that this still applies only to dangerous dogs? And if so, just to clarify, what kinds of things must the dog have done under the current language in order to be designated as dangerous?
Representative Tamar.
Mr. Chair, I suppose you got that right at your fingertips. Do you want to take a shot at it?
Mr. Forbes.
My name is Bill Forbes, Secretary of Treasurer of the Minnesota Animal Control Association. We're a nonprofit, all volunteer organization, animal control. To be declared dangerous, the first two things listed in the current law are without provocation if the dog inflicts substantial bodily harm on a human, or if it has killed a domestic animal without provocation while off the owner's property, which would be the dog gets loose, runs down the street, pulls Fluffy the dog off of its cable or out of its kennel and chews it up and kills it. Those two things would make the dog dangerous right away. The third thing would be if the dog is already declared potentially dangerous and it would, after that, aggressively bite, attack, or endanger the safety of humans or domestic animals, it would be declared dangerous. Which essentially means if the dog has chased the mailman down the street, he may have, you know, in obvious aggressive fashion, the dog would be declared potentially dangerous. The next time he did it would be declared dangerous, and the dog would not, in fact, have bitten anybody.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you. And my question, my follow-up question to you, Mr. Forbes, is in the case of the pit bull that killed the child in Minneapolis last August. Was there any information available prior to that time that would have allowed that animal to have been declared dangerous and fall under the purview of the still?
Mr. Ford.
Mr. Chair, Lesh, committee, I'm not totally well-versed on this case. What I understand is that the dog had been declared dangerous by the city of Minneapolis, and if I've got the right case. And it was required to be kept inside the house or locked up in a kennel or muzzled. And unfortunately, the problem occurred because somebody was in the house with the dog, and that's not covered.
Yeah. Representative Lesh.
And thank you, Mr. Ford, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Ford. I do want to work further on these issues. I think that many neighbors feel like they shouldn't have to wait for an animal to have committed serious bodily harm, which I think many people recognize as substantial, to another individual in order to be safe from an animal like this. It was my preference that we be able to do designation earlier on in the process, but I do appreciate your efforts and the efforts of Representative Tamar and some of the other people who are sitting in the room to get us, I think, what is a step in the right direction.
Are there any other questions?
Maybe some people who want to testify against the bill.
Or are there anyone in the audience wishing to testify? Oh, man. While you're coming forward, Representative Bigham has a question. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Paymer, I just had a question about Section 9, which deals with the city. You're authorizing the cities to regulate the dangerous dogs, but it has nothing to do with allowing cities to ban certain breeds or anything, right? Just for clarifying purposes? Section 9, you're allowing them to, you're adding potentially dangerous and dangerous dogs to the section. You're not allowing cities to ban certain breeds of the dog, correct? I just was wondering for clarification.
I'm sorry, I didn't
Thank you.
You need to come forward, sir. I'll let Representative Dominguez ask a quick question while you're getting settled in, because I didn't see him over there quite. I was sleeping on the job here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I do have regarding the purchase of the animals. When you purchase an animal either to the Humane Society or purchasing an animal to a store where you can purchase these animals. Is there anything in this bill that would talk to or counsel individuals on these animals that they're purchasing?
Chair?
Yes, Representative Chair.
No,
there's
not.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you.
Sir, you may go ahead. Yes, please state your name first.
My name is Al Kaczynskis. I'm a resident of St. Paul. I'm affiliated with Minnesota Responsible Animal Owners Alliance. And the concerns that I bring in spirit, first of all, on behalf of responsible animal owners in the state, I would like to thank you for doing a somewhat difficult, controversial job of dealing with this problem that exists in our state, especially in the metropolitan environment. Okay, so from here, when I refer to these, I guess I'm going to go off of the line on the bill, on the handouts. So in line 110, subdivision 8, where it says provocation, it's unreasonable to expect that every adult human being is capable of making decisions in regard to complex canine behavior. We all have different places to come from in our society, and dog behavior is not the easiest thing. It's not rocket science, but it's not always the easiest thing. There are different things that will provoke a dog that some of us that in the public at large may not be aware of, and I would just ask that be taken into consideration in the language of the bill. Secondly, in on the handout line 3.1 where it says contracted services under subdivision 9, I feel it's unreasonable. The amendment takes responsibility away from elected and accountable units of government and puts culpability on a private entity, which could result in additional litigation in the event of a dispute. Monies that may be a private concern that should actually go to the state, county, and municipality for administration and enforcement of the statute. Thirdly, there's under 347.52, and this is in line 324, it says an animal control authority shall require a dangerous dog to be sterilized. And I would ask, are there no exceptions? Never say never. For example, a very expensive show dog might be involved in something that isn't that big of a deal, but just because of the shall language, there's no room for exception, and you might destroy a relatively valuable animal. Fourthly, it talks about a hearing, and this would be in subdivision 2 on 347.56. This is in line 722, and the hearing before an impartial decision maker, and according to the dictionary, you know, a favoring neither, disinterested, treating all alike, unbiased, equitable, and just, you know, where will the impartial decision maker come from? Just a question in definition here. And the other comment, can I just say something above and beyond what's on the bill? There doesn't appear to be anything for record keeping that would be at a state level, a maintained database so that all counties, municipalities, et cetera, would have access to this information immediately, that they could just say, well, these are the dangerous dogs in the state, or we have this fellow moving in here and he's got a dangerous dog. So I thank you for the opportunity to come up and be of service, and that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Representative Paymer, your comments?
Mr. Forbes is really the expert on this, so he could probably fly through those concerns and provide a brief response.
Mr. Forbes.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, got a number of notes here. So with regard to Representative Mendez's question, I just might mention that most of the dogs that we end up finding dangerous are obtained from friends, relatives, other people in the community, and they're not going to get any counseling from anybody anyhow. As to provocation, there is no definition of provocation in the statute as it exists, and we produced this one as kind of model on a number of other definitions of provocation already in statute with regard to criminal law. And we have to have something, I believe, to give a hearing officer some clue what they're looking at. And I think this is an appropriate way to do it. As far as contract services, I believe Mr. Kaczynskis missed the part that it's the local government agency or local unit of government that's responsible for contracting agencies and so forth. It's not going to be a contractor who's going to have to say anything. As far as sterilization, absolutely. It reduces aggression in animals, and I don't know that we want to propagate a gene pool that's belongs to dangerous dogs. I don't see any point in that. And it's not just one incident of trivial nature. The dog will have been declared dangerous because of some serious problems in the first place. The impartial decision maker is really, in a lot of case law and elsewhere, it's been tested. State Supreme Court case right after this was passed in 1988, I believe, in the city of Minneapolis, made it clear impartial decision maker. Can be anybody who's not directly involved with the enforcement of the law. Most cities are using an outside attorney or somebody who does housing hearings or something like that. And I would just say in my city, we had somebody who did the housing hearings, and she reversed about half of the dangerous dog declarations that came to us, so we can hardly say she was getting influenced unduly. And as for the database, I'd love a database, but somebody needs to give us the money, and I think we all know where that's going.
Thank you, Mr. Forbes. Representative Paymar, is that directly related to this? Because otherwise Representative Biskins has a question.
I don't have any
testimony on it. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is for the issue of sterilization. I just want to know if there's some data which shows that a dangerous dog, that bites somebody is prone to breed more dogs that bite people. If so, then a matter of the whole. I guess is it genetic? Is it environment? Is the question. Is there data which shows that a dangerous dog breeds other dangerous dogs?
Mr. Forbes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins. There is abundant data to be had in veterinary journals and other places of that sort, indicating not so much that a particular breed has genes to do these things, but that an individual dog has both. It's the nature-nurture thing that's kind of been with us forever. But there may often be, frequently is, a genetic a component of that for a particular dog, and that's the reasoning behind it.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, if your witness could get us that data, the bill would make it to the floor. I would really appreciate it, yeah. I can understand the sterilization if there is demonstration that sterilization does calm a dog down. That I can understand that, but I'm skeptical about whether a dog who bites passes on that trait to the grooming process.
Yeah, I'll have that information.
I believe Representative Lesch has a question to this point. So.
Yeah, it was more of a comment to this point, Mr. Chair, and Representative Biskins. When I first brought this issue up last summer, it was related to memories that came through the other committee several years ago regarding Steve Strand's dangerous animal bill, whereby we regulated cougars and the fair cat howler situation when a person was mauled by a tiger. Most people have no question that those kinds of dangerous animals, you shouldn't be able to own a Bengal tiger and keep it in your garage. The excuse that people have in saying dogs are different is that they were domesticated. And they were domesticated out of their wild status through selective breeding. Thereby, it is also, I think, by virtue of that same argument, possible to breed animals that are more aggressive. And in fact, the statistics bear out that there are certain breeds that attack more and do more damage. Now, you can say that for whatever reason, that they're chosen by people who encourage that trait. Nonetheless, I think the answer to your question is that yes, you can breed animals to be more dangerous than you otherwise have. I think the question that probably should be before the committee, maybe not today, but in the future, is have we reached a point where we have bred or potentially can breed dogs which were previously considered domestic into more dangerous animals. So I think the answer to the question is yes.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pimmer, once there's been a series of actions that bring us to the point where we got a dog that we need to do something with, who makes the determination? What's the process for making the determination that it's a dangerous dog? If there's conditions here that have been met, whose decision is that? How is that challenged, or is there a process involved, or is it just the decision of an individual?
Representative Paymore.
Well, first of all, the dangerous dog would have had to have, I mean, the dog would have done something, as Mr. Forbes already talked about, inflicted substantially bodily harm on a human being or killed a domestic animal without provocation and been found to be a potentially dangerous dog, and after the owner has had noticed that the dog is potentially dangerous, then bite somebody else, and it would be up to the Animal Control Authority and whoever is the staff of the Animal Control Authority to do an investigation and make that determination. And then what we added in this bill that I think it provides a right to a hearing for someone who owns that dog if they can prove that that their dog is not dangerous. There's an independent, non-partial hearing to make that determination.
So that would be in the courts, then?
It could be in the courts, as I understand it. That's what happens in the Minneapolis and St. Paul, or no? Is that
Mr. Forbes?
Mr. Chairman, part of the problem of this whole area of regulating dangerous dogs is that there's such a patchwork of animal control around the state, depending on where you happen to be. And the hearing appeals process would undoubtedly be different as well. Minneapolis and St. Paul use people from within the city because they have a large staff. Metro area uses outside attorneys who are hired by the city. I've heard some cities using other people from within the local government. It's kind of a local decision based on whatever kind of situation the local government has.
Representative Easton, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I guess that was kind of my point, is that this is a not a very scientific process for declaring dogs to be dangerous. And I understand that that's a difficult thing to do, and maybe that's one area that we could tighten this bill up or this process up a little bit to create a more uniform process. So it isn't as much the opinion of an animal control officer as it is maybe a more unified process that occurs similarly everywhere. And that's just something, just a suggestion. Another question I was just going to ask, I think people own dogs for different purposes. And in my case, I live on 200 plus acres on a farm, and I've got a lot of property, I've got equipment and that sort of thing. And we've always had a dog as a family pet, and it was operated as a family pet, but we always chose a dog that also gained the respect of intruders. And so we've always had a German Shepherd. We never had a pit bull, but we've always had a German Shepherd, and found that, you know, we've had, I think, four or five different ones, and found that they've all had many different temperaments. And we had one situation probably 25 years ago now, when my children were young, where we had a German Shepherd who was a very friendly dog. And I guess maybe I should preface this remark, because I don't think any politician has ever questioned a dog's right to bite him on the heels when they're up at a door knocking on a door. Because dogs are very protective. And a lot of people have them for that reason. So in my case, we had a situation where two of my kids, I think they were 3 and 5 at the time, were playing in the garden, which was out fairly close to the road while I was mowing the lawn. And two people came by on their bikes. Well, I didn't know, and we didn't know, and they came with their bikes, and when they saw my kids, they just drove off the road down in the ditch right up to the garden. And my dog was there, and he bit one of them. And I thought it was a provocation for somebody to come onto my property to my little kids when nobody was technically around, and my dog ended up being declared a dangerous dog. And that concerned me a little bit. And I guess I'm just concerned that what we do here respects how people have dogs, how people take care of their dogs, because that dog never bit anyone else, And we always were outside when it was loose, but it definitely was a dog that was meant to be there to create some respect for people from coming up and intruding on our property. And so I just say it isn't always a very clear-cut case. And there should be a way, I think, for people to look at that issue and maybe make an appeal just to understand the issue that we're discussing a little bit there. That's very different than the issues that Mr. Les is concerned about, I think, and I totally agree with what he's concerned about. But I think we're stretching this out a little farther, and it affects different people differently. So that's just a comment, and I guess it would be helpful to go on at this point.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar on page 2, line 2.24. Answer line you put inserted beam between the dog and you. They can see a dangerous dog used by law enforcement. Now it's being used. What did that?
I have a two question. It was intended to be clarification of the language, make it more understandable. I can see where there might be some issues with that.
Representative Seymour, I was wondering if you would mind if we struck that. The reason being is because when you get into being used, law enforcement dogs actually are being used all the time, whether they're used for a dangerous dog for a bite work or for sniff work. You take them out to elementary schools, they're a great PR tool in the playground. And then when they're home, they're being trained by the owner, so they're being used about all the time. This language worries me about, it kind of gives the inference that being used might mean only for like a dog and a canine being used for bite work, and then all the other time you'd have to have a sign around his neck or something or at home. So I'm just wondering if it seems okay the way it is, and it might create some ambiguity. I wonder if we could write that with an amendment.
Representative Cornish, is that your amendment then?
Yes.
Strike B from line 2.24.
Yes, sir.
Is there any discussion? See no discussion. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion. Amendment carries. Representative Hodge, did you have?
Okay.
Representative Coles.
Chairman, very quickly, Representative Paymar, just above where we were talking with Representative Cornish, the section regarding the fee. I know you're not changing current law with regard to the fee, but maybe through your witness, can you tell me what kind of a fee is currently charged? I guess, Representative Eastland just shared a story about his dog being declared dangerous, and there is no cap, as I read the law right now, in terms of what type of fee could be charged. Again, I know you're not changing it, but maybe, do we know, is there a range across the state, or is it consistent?
Mr. Forbes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Forbes, members of the committee, I believe there is a cap. I'm looking anxiously as we speak about it. The question of the going fee, as it were, it's not terribly high in my experience. I don't know if anybody's charging the maximum. I know within Hennepin County, I think we're on around $30 or $35 to cover the cost of the sign and the tag and the paperwork, which I think is low.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to make any kind of amendment, but I guess, if I start hearing stories about fees at $1,000 a pop or something like that, I just, I don't want to go there. I don't think we need to go there. If we're talking $30, $35, that seems to be completely reasonable to me, but I would be concerned if we were, if animal control authorities were using this provision basically as a way to make a dangerous dog, like Representative Eastland described, as a dog declared dangerous, cost prohibitive to own.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Coles. Are there any other questions? Any other persons wanting to be heard back there? Seeing no other testimony, no further questions, Representative Paymar moves his motion that House File 2906 is amended to be recommended to pass and return to finance with a recommendation for a re-referral to the General Register. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Representative Paymar. The desire is to doing House File 2996 at this stage.
If Mr. President Atkins is not here, then why don't we do this? I would.
Representative Paymar moves House File 2996 be recommended to pass and return to Finance with the recommendation to refer it to a general register. Representative Paymar, is there an author's amendment to this bill?
Yes, there's a substantial one.
Would you care to move the amendment?
Then you and I are going to do this. We'll get as much as possible. I would like to move the DE2 amendment.
Representative Paymar moves the DE2 amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is moved.
Mr. Chair, members, unfortunately, the realities of our budget constraints and the deficit that we're facing has resulted in us deleting most of the bill that we had Representative Eastland and I had originally each introduced. That was really the work of county attorneys and public defense, probation officers and interested parties and Sentencing Guidelines Commission to deal with the issue of offender reentry in society. I think we had a good bill trying to break down some of the obstacles that ex-offenders face when they try to reintegrate back into society. As you know, I think some of you were on the policy committee. We had the County Attorneys Association that reported the certificate of good conduct that an ex-offender could obtain so they could gain employment and housing, etc. And unfortunately, the fiscal note has come back saying that this would be $1 a year. So we've had to take those provisions out of the bill. So what we have left of the bill, which is the amendment, is that let me back up just a moment or two there. Some of you may have read the 2007 Sentencing Guidelines Commission report to the legislature, and in that report, they in trying to get a handle on our drug sentencing in the state of Minnesota, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission stated basically it is for our elected representatives in the legislature to decide whether the time has come to overhaul Minnesota's drug laws. Any major changes should be based on thorough consideration of the entire legal structure in light of current data and research. Two meaningful reformative actions can be accomplished in the 2007 legislative session without major revision of the drug laws, and the two are, if the legislature determines it is desirable, the Guidelines Commission can readily re-rank the first degree and second degree offenses by moving each down one severity level, and two, the legislature may choose to fund the state court's initiative for the expansion of drug courts in Minnesota. Well, in our omnibus bill last year, we basically have this as the language in the bill, but when the Sentencing Guidelines Commission met to look at this re-ranking, there was considerable concern by the County Attorneys Association as well as the Governor's Office. Sentencing Guidelines Commission essentially pushed it all back to the legislature. And now I think we have a workable solution here where we're now going to create a working group. You can see the membership on page one of the DE2 amendment that is really quite comprehensive. a county attorney, a public defense, police officers, a judicial counsel, and also members of two representatives from communities, neighborhoods, and that are particularly affected by drug dealing and drug and violence that's associated with that. So we're asking the working group to study the. If you look at page 2, you will see what the responsibility of the working group will be. And I have a number of witnesses here. We have a number of witnesses here. If you'd like to hear from them on these on the responsibilities of the working group, and the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has agreed to facilitate this process. So that's the.
Representative Easton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just simply say that one of the things, I guess, that the longer you hear, the more you realize is that progress is always incremental. And usually we start out with higher aspirations than that can easily be achieved. And I would just like to say that I've been on this committee almost 8 years now. This is my eighth year. Eighth year in the legislature, sixth year on this committee. And I guess one of the things that I've always struggled with since my first year on here was just trying to understand how we could continue to have the revolving door of our prison system happening, and you know I think it's 30% of our prison population recidivates after they're released within 3 years, and it seems to me as we grow in our populations that are in our correction system, which since I've been here started out around 7,000 and now it's up over 9,500 or something like that. As we see that number climb, one of the most cost-effective ways we could affect that is if we could take away the obstacles that people leaving our prison system have to face and increase their chances of being successful at integrating back into society. That's kind of what this was about. It focused a lot on the drug offenses, but I think in general that's the big principle that we're trying to do, is try to figure out how we can make productive people after they've served their time and done their punishment, how we can make productive people back in our society. And I think it's a notable goal, and I think we should continue to work on it. And I think what we have here today is a micro step in keeping us going down that road. So I appreciate the support of the committee and the work of Representative Paymar and all the members of the working group that worked on this proposal over the summer. So that's basically our support.
Representative Biskin, you have a comment, question? Bingham, oh, my mistake, Representative Bingham. I shouldn't say it, but normally it might be this.
thank you, Chair Paymar, Representative Easton, for bringing this forward. I just want to, for clarification, you're asking this working group to advise and to make recommendations. You're not asking them to actually change things. This is going to be something that, in essence, we will come back as a legislature and have a say over and go over this report next year if we're all lucky to come back.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chairman, on page 1, subdivision 2, it states that the working group must review, assess, and make specific recommendations regarding the following alternatives for modification and application of the closed controlled substance laws. It makes recommendations the legislature would still have to act. The report is due on January 16,
2009. Are there any... First off, what I'm going to do, Representative Paymar, in the essence of time, I'm going to ask, is there anybody opposed to this bill? Because if there isn't, we may not need to hear from the testimony.
Probably not, but
yes, there's somebody that wants to make a comment back there. Please come forward. I know, I'm playing. I have 6 hours yet to drive tonight, so.
I'm Isabel Gomez. I'm the Executive Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Certainly don't oppose the bill, but do want to set out on the record what I believe my agreement with legislative staff has been concerning the Guidelines Commission's role. Obviously, or certainly obvious to us, the subject here is well within the traditional competency of the commission, and indeed we're the ones that have, I think, the most technical expertise concerning data and how to structure in terms of our present sentencing system, how we might structure changes. So you're an important constituent, we certainly would expect to provide data and advice about how you might create grids, et cetera, to this committee. We do have to be very mindful of our time and of our money. And time is more important. Last year, we did, on behalf of the legislature, did chair and staff the collateral sanctions committee, and we really appreciated the ability to participate in that work. It was a very rich experience. However, it did have the impact on us of delaying for an entire year a very important, groundbreaking piece of research concerning racial disparity in sentencing in Minnesota, and we must move forward with that research. So we have to constrain our role here a little bit, and I just want to set out a I expect that the commission, based on conversations with Ms. Lacombe and other staffers, expect that the commission will not be doing logistics like setting meetings, finding meeting rooms, doing minutes, that kind of thing. And so if the legislative staff has expressed a willingness to do that work, and that's our expectation. Secondly, as to time. Last year, the legislature assigned the Guidelines Commission the work of assessing the impact on recidivism of new drug court programs and new reentry programs. We have taken that assignment seriously, and I've had at least two staff members for at least 9 hours a month working with the drug courts. So that's 18 hours. That assignment, or the report, which is due, we had a mini report this year, another report is due next year, is of almost no value to the legislature, because there is not time to assess the impact on recidivism of programs, some of which have not yet opened their doors. Secondly, our participation in terms of measuring recidivism is now clearly redundant, because the court has an RFP to hire outside experts to advise them on recidivism and how it should be measured and so on. And those folks have a lot more resources than we would ever have. So that's sort of being taken care of by the court. Similarly, with the reentry programs, the DOC, who have wonderful researchers that we work with all the time, DOC researchers are monitoring impact on the recidivism of those reentry programs. So we would respectfully request, Mr. Chair and members, that there be a repeal of what's left of that little bill that assigned that recidivism measurement responsibility, because it would save us a lot of time. And I'm embarrassed that I don't know, as I'm sitting here, the number of that bill, but we should get it to staff. Finally, the governor in his budget recognized the impact on small agencies of taking even 3% and left us alone. In our case, 3% is $18,000, which is not going to take you far in dealing with the state's budget, but it means a great deal for our agency. And so we would ask in exchange for our willingness to do writing, to do sort of advising on agendas and sort of helping steer the flow of the work, which is beyond our usual purview. We would respectfully ask that in exchange for that, it be allowed to our budget to go along. That's all I have to say.
Well, in this particular bill, we probably won't be able to address that repeal by any means, because that's
But, I forgot all about this. I did talk to Gomez about that. I think maybe we can try to find some rider language that would fit in our supplemental budget. So.
Are there any other witnesses that want to be heard on this? I did try to railroad you out, I guess. If there's anybody that wants to. Representative Coles has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gomez just raised an issue, and Chair Paymer, I don't know if you have any information, but she mentioned an RFP that the courts have out for some research, and I found that a bit curious, given the courts' concerns about their correct concerns, I think, about their budget and their personnel. Do you know anything about this RFP and what kind of money the courts are spending on it, or if there's anybody here from the courts who could? I don't see anything.
Mr. Carter is indicating he doesn't know either, so I'm not.
All right, Mr. Chair, my only comment, I guess, is I find it interesting that, there's from the courts, from the agencies, from everybody, and understandably so, there's a plea that, we have no room to cut, but then we hear that they're, and maybe this is critical research that needs to be done this year, or maybe it's something that can be done in 18 months or 2 years. Not having somebody here from the courts to better describe what it is, I don't know, and I'm not trying to impugn the courts here either. I mean, we see this across state governments, and I find it interesting, in these difficult times, there is going to be a need to reprioritize, and I just wanted to make that comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cole. Are there any witnesses desiring to come forward? Seeing no witnesses coming forward, Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 2996 be recommended be passed as amended and returned to finance with a recommendation for a re-referral to the General Registry. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Sorry, John. I don't see any reason to call on me.
Back in front of the committee, the chair will move House File 3876 to be recommended to pass and return to finance with a recommendation for re-referral to the General Register. Okay. Do you have any amendments that you want to offer?
I do, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate it if the chair, it's an oral amendment simply to delete Section 3 of the bill. And that will put it into the shape in which we desire it to be.
So, Representative Atkins, the chair will move that we delete Section 3 of the bill, which is the appropriation section. Is there any discussion?
On
Those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Representative Atkins, please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to be relatively brief, maybe even as fast as I just ran down the hallway to get here. I didn't want to miss the opportunity to present the bill. It's 3876. It's a very straightforward bill. It allows for loan repayment with respect to public defenders. And what we're encountering, Mr. Chair, it's about making the system work and keeping it working as well as we can. The difficulty for many folks that would like to do public defender work is that their law school loans are eating them up, and so they work as a public defender, and then they can't afford to continue doing that. Just about the time when they're really getting good at what they're doing, they got to go out and find other work that they can that allows them to pay off their loans. And this allows for them to hopefully continue working in the public defender's office and continue to be effective and efficient. It is a bill that will hopefully make the system work better and make it work more effectively and efficiently. And the one change that we need with respect to the appropriation, we recognize that there's probably not a whole lot of money going around this year, Mr. Chair. But this will begin the process of setting up the process under which this program would occur. And if there hopefully is some funding available next time around, we'll be able to hit the ground running with respect to it. And with that, I have some brief testimony for you as well.
Hi. Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Cuddy. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. First of all, thanks, Representative Atkins and Chairman Yu, for not only bringing the bill forward, but carrying the bill. As the author indicated, we're really dealing with a couple of situations that are facing us. One is the recruitment of public defenders, particularly part-time defenders in greater Minnesota, but also the retention of existing staff. And it really amounts to five issues that we're facing. One is a baby boom workforce, recruitment of part-timers in greater Minnesota, retention of public defenders, increasing law school debt, and a federal program that has the potential to set up a somewhat divisive situation, I would say not only in our office, but probably in a number of offices. Chairman, you all should have gotten a handout, and I wish Representative Smith were here. I'd apologize for having color handouts again. our lone color printer in the office broke down, so I actually had to go to the copy center to get these printed. So, on page 4, it starts the issue of the baby boom workforce. About 40% of our part-time defenders are age 50 plus. About 30% of all public defenders are over age 50. And I mentioned this the other day, we've had kind of an inverted bell curve, if you will, of where our folks fall on a seniority scale. An awful lot of folks that just started with us in the first few years of their work with us, there's an awful lot of folks who are kind of on the top of that scale, the top of the seniority list. Particularly if you look at page 5, the percent of public defenders who are over age 55 who are part-time, about 74% of them. These are the folks who have, in the past, been part of small-time law firms, one- or two-person firms, who have basically donated their time, but they're working three-quarter time, maybe half-time for us. And we're having a really, very difficult time trying to replace those folks. You know, Mr. Chairman, some of you have been around here for a while, they are paid a set salary, three-quarter or half-time of what we pay a full-timer. We don't pay for their office. We don't pay for their secretary. We don't pay for a lot of the overhead costs that go into being an attorney. And those of you who are attorneys who have been in private practice, you know for every dollar that you make, about half of it probably goes to overhead. They do get a small overhead stipend, but it obviously isn't enough to cover their overhead. So if you look on page 6, one of the things that really brought this to our attention was a recent study by the Equal Justice Works, who did a survey that found that 68% of public interest and government employers were having difficulty recruiting lawyers. We found that out. The last two part-time positions that we had open in northern Minnesota, one in the 9th Judicial District and one in the 6th Judicial District. The one process had 3 applicants, one person who hadn't graduated from law school yet. And in the 6th District, we had nobody apply for a part-time position there. So it's been a very difficult situation for us in terms of how do we keep that part-time model of public defense going, which is obviously very cost-effective for us and for you all, in light of kind of this aging workforce that we have. I think you saw it in nurses. I think you've seen it with the doctors in some of the rural hospitals, rural kinds of things. As far as retention of attorney staff, Mr. Chairman, on page 7 of that handout, last year we did a survey, actually started in 2006, of public defenders. And what we found was that 42% of them thought it was highly likely or likely that they would leave public service because of law school debt. That's an astounding number. What was very astounding to us even at that point was we had about a 10% attrition rate among our lawyer staff in 2000, I think it was 2005 and 2006. Obviously that's not good for us, it's not good for the court, it's not good for prosecutors. We either don't have the people or we're bringing new people in all of the time. Beginning on page 8, Mr. Chairman, in terms of the issue of law school debt and again of recruiting and retention, we saw, according to the ABA, a recent study by the ABA, 267% increase in law school tuition since 1990. And those of you who serve on higher ed or in those areas, you're well aware of that situation. The most alarming thing that we saw from that ABA study was about 66% of the graduates indicated that debt prevented them from pursuing a public service career. That was astounding to us because we've been able to, at least in the past, attract some of the better and some of the brighter law school students because they want to go into public service, they believe in the work, and what's been difficult is to see this evolve as this mounting debt has prevented folks from going into this work. So that's why we're here. On page 10 gives you an outline of kind of where our folks are at in that same survey. About 90% of our lawyers reported having law school debt at some point or another. Currently, about 65% of them have some kind of law school debt. The average debt is $74,000. About $585, $586 is the average monthly payment. And again, what's very concerning to us is about 54% of the respondents had 6 or less years of experience. So we are talking about a very big group of folks in our organization who this is impacting. Lastly, Mr. Chairman, with regard to the federal program, last fall, Congress passed and the President signed a College Cost Reduction Act. In that act, it allows for loan forgiveness for public service work after 10 years. What we found out from talking to our public defenders and from the survey was, A, is that a number of them would not qualify for that, and B, those that might, it wasn't economically advantageous for them to do so. A number of them consolidated their loans several years ago. They would have to reconsolidate those loans or under a federal program to then be eligible for the 10-year loan forgiveness, but it would be at a higher interest rate. So they all would be basically gambling that they, in fact, would still be public defenders or in some kind of public service work 10 years from now. The other part of the federal loan program is it does not apply to part-time defenders. It only is for full-time folks. And again, that's one of the target groups here, especially, like I said, in greater Minnesota, about 60% of our lawyers are part-time, and that really is a key demographic for us. Chairman, I'm going to quit there because you took the appropriation section out, unless you want me to talk about the numbers that we came up with or how we came up with them, but I leave that to you. I do have one assistant public defender here who would like to take 2 minutes just to kind of share her story of and she's fairly typical of what we have in terms of folks, but I'll leave it at that.
afternoon, Chairman, committee members. My name is Corey Thurman, and I'm an assistant public defender here in St. Paul in the Second Judicial District. And I was actually fortunate enough to get a scholarship to law school. 75% of my tuition was paid for by Hamline University. However, I still work two additional part-time jobs to be able to pay off my law school loans. I have about $65,000 in law school loans. I also have loans from my undergraduate studies that I'm paying off as well. And I thought that I was in a bad position until I spoke to another woman in my office who actually is paying $1,000 a month in student loan repayments. And given the fact that our pay scale starts at about $50,000 a year, I can't imagine how long she will be able to tough that out. I know that some people can take advantage of deferments, but deferments only last for so long. From my perspective, I love my job, and I went into public service because I believe in defending the Constitution, and I believe in public service. But at some point, I, like many other people who have left my office, may want to have a family and will no longer be able to afford to continue to be a public defender. We recently had one woman who left our office to become a prosecutor because they pay prosecutors more than public defenders. And it's an extremely unfortunate situation for our clients and for the court system as a whole, because I do believe that we are an integral part of the court system, and we do a better service to our clients and to the system when we're not working multiple jobs and when we're not worried about paying our loans and paying our rent. And I have nothing else to say unless anybody has any questions.
Any questions, the witness?
Yeah, I have the
question.
Is it of the witness or of Mr. Kyer?
No, it's a general comment, basically.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my general comment, by the way, is contrary to what you may think coming from the Public Defender's Office. I've always dreamed and talked about this as being a fair way. Unfortunately, to bring a bill only being the public defenders when the prosecutors of the state of Minnesota have the exact same situation, there's no way I can support this bill in its present form. The idea is a great form, but when Mr. Kyer made a valid point, he indicated government attorneys. And we're all in the same world. It's not just the public defenders that are in this world. Everybody that's in government service is in the same situation. So if there's a way to amend it to include prosecutors, I think it would be the fair and just thing to do.
Chairman, if I might, just a couple of comments. First of all, I understand Representative Boland's point, and we have had some discussions with the folks in the Minnesota County Attorneys Association about this very issue, because they are facing some of the same issues. I would point out, however, that they do have some repayment options or loan forgiveness options through, I think it's a federal Perkins bill back. And I'm not that familiar with, but I know that they have some access to that. Secondly, is that there's nothing that prevents Pennington County or Hennepin County or even Ramsey County from providing this kind of option or benefit to their folks. You know, a number of years ago, and Chairman, you were here for part of it, is we converted a system from a county-based system to a state-based system. And that's why we're here, because these are state employees who are having difficulty keeping courthouses running and keeping folks in the courthouses. So if there's a way, Mr. Chairman, to do it, we certainly would be looking at it, but it's just, at least at this point, wasn't something that anybody was willing to tackle. So,
Representative, thank you. I was expecting an answer that we'd work to do this. I wasn't expecting an answer telling me, as a former county attorney who lost two assistants because of this issue years ago, and also paid his own bills while he was Pennington County Attorney, and a part-time county attorney, mind you, not full-time in those days. I wasn't full-time in 1998. So I had 20-some years of part-time before it was legal. I thought we'd be seeking fairness here, and you say this is a great idea. I never dreamed in my wildest imagination that the public defenders would sit here and tell me we should get a benefit protection like with the rural Minnesota prosecutor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for Ms. Sherman. The federal government recently passed an act that would help if your school debt increased, or I'm sorry, I don't know the exact debt, but if you, over the course of 10 years, are you familiar with the federal act I'm talking about?
Representative Lesh, I am vaguely familiar with that, though I know that there are several forms that are being debated at this point, I believe. What I can say about how that bill applies to several people in my office is that a number of us had already consolidated our student loans at a lower interest rate, and to reconsolidate would not make financial sense. But the real issue with regards to that is that many people in my office are having issues paying the payments now. And I don't believe that that federal program actually does anything to alleviate the payments that are causing people to have to work multiple jobs now. I believe that the relief in that federal program comes 10 years from now, which is not of much help, unfortunately.
Wait, one second. Can you just give us your name again, please, and share?
Yes, it's Corey Sherman. It's CoreySherman.
Mr. Lush, you still have the floor here. And as Mr. Sherman, always good to see you. I don't know how many trials we've had together, but I'm certain it's under 5. So maybe I can say it's not always good to see you.
They've all been jury trials.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sherman, can you state in Ramsey County what the rate of turnover has been in your office since you've been there?
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yes, I can. Representative Lesh, as I believe you are aware, I was hired about 2.5 years ago as an attorney, and I was hired in a class of about eight attorneys. Since that time, four have left. One woman, as I mentioned, went to become a prosecutor because the prosecutors make more money than public defenders. Another two individuals actually went into private practice. And I believe another individual has left as well. I don't recall where she went specifically. But there has been a lot of turnover in our office. And that is unfortunately a trend that I would expect to continue. Prior to my being hired as an attorney, I was a law clerk in our office. And I do know that it's right about the 5-year mark when people started leaving. Some of our more experienced attorneys started leaving and going into private practice because they could no longer afford to work in our office.
Mr. Chair, just by the way,
how much?
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members. And I echo partially Representative Olin's concerns. I would like to say public attorneys rather than public defenders, because I do see there being some difficulty in prosecutors as well. I'm able to supplement my money by being in the legislature for 5 months and actually make more aggregate between the two. But and also there is an attorney I know who went from my office, city attorney's office, to the public defender's office for more money, and he's still there. That said, I do honestly like working with more senior public defenders, experienced public defenders.
Mr.
Chair, mostly, some of the most Mickey Mouse trials I've had are with public defenders who I think maybe wouldn't be trying cases if, in fact, they knew more about the system. And I'm sure public defenders can say the same about new prosecutors as well. This is why I think this program is pretty important, and I support it. I do think that prosecutors have problems as well because they're both public attorneys, but just the turnover that I've seen in my experience is problematic for the entire court system.
Representative Atkins, you always seem to manage to bring a non-controversial bill to the legislature. Representative Cornish is...
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
We have a number of questions.
Mr. Chairman, I just kind of think this should be a higher ed situation in their area rather than us starting off in this venture. I believe in general tuition assistance, scholarship assistance, things like this, but to single out certain professions. I mean, my two kids that went through college, I think they just... They've been out for 8 years, and they just recently paid off their loans, and they'd love to have their professions included in some type of repayment assistance. But to pick winners and losers like this at certain professions and then open it up, and I'm sure the finance chairs are worried about opening up another gateway to more repayment plans and coming out of the budget. So if it was general assistance for different professions or for college, I can see it, but I'm having a stretch with this one.
Is that Atkins, you want to
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I might, you familiar with the ad, Representative Cornish, where the fella goes up, the commercial is everybody's moving around paying, using their credit card, and all of a sudden somebody tries to pay cash, and the whole system comes to a crashing halt. That's why I'm presenting this bill in this fashion. What I mean by that is that this is about the court system. Why in the world would some civil practice guy, I don't do any criminal stuff, why would I be carrying this bill? The reason is because it's the whole system is like a series of gears. And if any one gear isn't able to move smoothly, it slows down the entire machine. And that's my perception right now with respect. This isn't about, I'm on higher ed. If I wanted to present a general assistance scholarship program or loan repayment program, I know where to do it. This is about the court system. I have seen firsthand what happens if any part of our court system doesn't work well, is it slows down then the prosecutors. And when all the resources go towards that and the judges get frustrated with that part of the system, it slows down my world. Which means it slows down for all of our consumers of the court system. All of our constituents out there are the ones that then suffer for that. What I would suggest that we, and what I would appreciate doing, is to continue to process the bill. We've taken the appropriation out. Y'all still control the checkbook. But let's start the process, see what sort of program we could put in place. And Representative Olin, I think you make an excellent point. If with deference to the chair, I'd like to try to address that issue as well. I just, my son just went down to spring training. The other son couldn't because it just didn't match up schedule-wise and with the ability to go at the same time. He's still going to go. It's just going to be next time around. I would be more than happy to work with you on that very bill. I think there's distinct differences here between one that's funded generally at the county level and one that's funded at the state level, and I would keep that separate. But I'd love to do that because I see the same thing happening to our prosecutors as are happening to our public defenders. But I think the first step is to move this, make sure that it's in the works, because we're not going to have any money this year anyway, but to start this process down, keep the efforts being made and see how far we can get with it. And then I'll just be happy to work with you, Representative Wong, on that as well.
Hold on, Representative Cliff, we've got to close the next, but to this point, go ahead, Representative Wong.
No, okay, I'll let Representative
close,
and I'll get back to you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Atkins, I don't have any problem with the policy behind your bill, what you're trying to do here. In fact, I agree with it. I recognize the challenges that the Public Defender's Office has, the prosecutors have, state agencies have in hiring and retaining lawyers when private law firms are, have starting salaries in the $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 range, and that's not unheard of at all anymore. And so I recognize that challenge. I guess the concern I have about your bill is exactly what you were just hitting on. We got rid of the appropriation. So Mr. Kyer comes and talks to me every year about the challenges that the Public Defender's Office has with this budget without this program there, and its inability to meet some of its expenses. And we did a supplemental, and we've got challenges right now without this program. I'm not sure that we really need this legislation for the Public Defender's Office to figure out how this program might work when and if there is money for it. My concern is we put this into statute now, and You know, we give public defender's office another reason to say that, you know, they don't have enough money, and they don't right now. They don't have enough money. They have challenges, but here we're creating yet another challenge, another unfulfilled obligation on the part of the legislature. That's the concern I have, is that we're setting something up that we're not ready today to fund, and we may not be ready for a long time, and we're maybe setting some expectations with the office or with the attorneys in the office that this is coming down the pipe.
Mr. Carr.
Chairman, I'd like to address a couple of those issues. We recognize that Representative Cole, when we brought the bill forward, that that might be an issue. Our issue and with our board is we've got to look at a long-term situation. As I showed you in the charts, we have a number of those folks, particularly in Greater Minnesota, but also here in the metro, that are over age 50 or 55. We've got to start looking at how are we going to replace those people. I don't want to come back here 2 years from now or 4 years from now and say, you know what, I need X number of full-time offices in small towns around the state because I can't find part-time defenders to do this work. That's not cost-effective for us, certainly not cost-effective for you. So we understand that it's kind of a juxtaposition here, but we felt these are the kinds of issues that are affecting our folks. We heard from our public defenders that this is a big issue for them, so we wanted to put it out there. We want to at least get it, again, we understand the money situation, at least put it out there, get the authority to do it, so we can at least start pulling that together. If we don't have the money to do it, I can assure you we're not going to do it. But, well, I'll just leave it at that.
Mr. Chair, I guess my question would be, is there something that would preclude the board from doing this right now without the legislation? Do you not have the authority to take a look and you know, create the model program for when there is funding?
Mr. Kaya.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Coles, we don't believe we have the authority to actually have the program.
No.
So,
Representative Atkins.
That's why I'm here.
A quick point to that, and Representative Coles and Flesh and others serve on the tax committee together. You may actually be able to get more bang for your buck doing it in this fashion than in money going directly towards salaries as well. Not that I would ever say don't put it towards salaries. But if I am in Ms. Sherman's position and you offer me some money towards loan repayment that may not count towards my W-2 income versus money on my W-2, I might actually opt for this and it costs the state less money. I throw that out as a possibility, but I think there probably is some upside there too. So it might be in your financial best interest to at least allow this possibility.
Representative Lee Dunn.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and well, there's a whole lot here that I'd like to respond to, but members have made really good comments, and I really appreciate the discussion today. This is a problem of school debt problem, and it really is pervasive through a lot of public interest areas, certainly not just this one, and you all know that I, you know, have a particular place in my heart for public defense, so, you know, I certainly recognize the problem. To represent Cornish, I just would like to say, well, I really appreciate your concern. I think that we, the legislature, do often kind of pick and choose where to focus resources on different professions because of shortages, and that's something that's we're talking about in healthcare with regard to rural physicians and nursing shortages and all these kind of things. So I think our challenge is kind of to figure out how to do that carefully and where the need is to encourage different kinds of, help different professions stay afloat and different public interest in particular. But I want to kind of raise one issue, and then I also have a question. And the issue I want to raise is an equity issue that's a little bit different, and that is between different public defenders. And I know the bill itself sets out, you know, that you're going to kind of figure this out later is more or less what the bill says. But I know that I've heard some concern expressed by various public defenders about how this can be done in a way that is fair across public defenders because, you know, those who've been working a long time and have paid off their loans under difficult circumstances could rightly say, well, you know, nobody helped me. Why are you now helping the new attorneys and so on? So there's that issue. And I'd like you to address that. And the second piece, though, is I'd like to know what the trend is on the number of lawyers who are coming out of school and what the trend is on jobs for lawyers. Because when you're talking about being able to hire and retain, that all happens in a context of how many jobs there are. And I remember years when, boy, people would have loved to have gotten a public defender job at any salary just to get started because it was so hard to find a job. So if you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Kier. Yeah.
Chairman and Representative Lieber. First to the equity issue. As I mentioned in my presentation, about 65% of the public defenders have some debt right now. I don't expect that as we replace or hope to replace those who are age 55 or above right now, as we replace them, that we're going to replace them with folks that don't have law school debt. I think in this day and age, I just don't think that's going to happen. Is there an equity issue for some of those folks that are around? Yes. But I will say that we also have collective bargaining agreements with both our attorneys and our support staff where those issues will obviously be played out in some fashion. As to your second point about, you know, it does go in cycles. There's no question about that. But what we're looking at is the long-term situation here. And again, I remind you that we're looking at, and you're very familiar with this from where you come from, about the part-time defenders in greater Minnesota, because we're always having difficulty finding those folks. And we're always, that one seems to be a constant no matter what. The days of us saying, gee, we'll give you a part-time public defender contract, come hang your shingle out in, Clearwater County, and then pick up a few cases on the civil side, maybe do some divorce work, some PI work. That just doesn't happen anymore. We just don't have those situations.
That's not very much. You done?
Yeah.
Oh, Representative Owl. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to start these clauses by pointing out a different angle that I didn't get to. I do have a couple more questions, but basically, if you were to go into northern Minnesota and listen to my comments I've made at county boards, city councils, and school districts, you're going to find one common thread when it comes to education. And that common thread has been, we have a shortage of all professionals in northern Minnesota, from doctors to chiropractors to dentists to county attorneys to prosecutors. And I name them all. I do not leave the county attorney or the prosecutor or the public defender sitting out there left out of any discussion I've had up there. So fairness issue, that's my comment on that. Because I have said that someday I'm going to figure out a way to get legislation that will address all those shortages we have. And believe me, there are shortages. I can name in the dentist world, for instance, there's 5 dentists in Thief River Falls and 4 of them will probably retire within 3 years. I don't know where they are then with 8,000 people, but so there's a big problem up there, and I've always addressed it as everybody's professional problem, not the public defenders over here and the heck with anybody else. But leaving that issue, what I will say, and I have to respond slightly to the can't get part-time public defenders. Since I left my office 1 year and 3 months ago, in Pennington County, we have added 2, and I repeat, 2 part-time public defenders. That's in 15 months since I left office, you have 2. You haven't cut back on the 3 full-time you had, but you did add 2 part-time. And you're looking for another one, from what I understand. So evidently part-time is doing just somewhere out there. And really what I think we need to address, and the reason I'm speaking right now, is I think this needs somewhat of an unfair advantage. And I know you can use the state funding and that's all fine, but to set up the legislation that I think you need for any one of these jobs, and that's enabling legislation, whether it's funded by the state or funded by the county, whoever, the counties don't have any, and they don't have the authority to set up this enabling legislation. It would not exist anywhere in the county's power.
So you're setting up something for the public defenders that a county cannot legally do without enabling legislation from the state. And that's got to be, in my mind, considering I think my assistant's going to have to react to four attorneys in town. You're going to have to do something, and if a public defender can hire and have this loan program to offer, and my assistant, who's now county attorney, doesn't, that's a fair playing field. Not anywhere near fair. You need enabling legislation to address both ends. And I, believe me, I'm behind this idea 100%. This idea is a good idea. It needs to be expanded beyond this, but I'm not dealing with beyond this profession. I'm not dealing with the others here because I haven't got a bill. But it needs to be expanded from an enabling legislation on both the prosecutor and the county attorney and the public defender. Because the way it reads, and it doesn't do that. You'll give a public defender that, but the county attorney cannot go and legally try to start that in Pennington County, because the statute specifically set out exactly what the county's jobs can do. The county's jobs as a private county, by state law, are some of the most restrictive statute allowing them to do things that exist. So you'd be creating an uneven playing field to put an enabling today without also addressing the enabling on the other side. And should it be done? Yes, it should be done on both sides. I'm 100% behind that idea, but I can't support the non-fair playing field.
That's some question that we probably should move on.
Mr. Chairman, I don't mind moving this out today and voting for it. Over the noon hour, I activated a college grad that is going to be a cop starting this weekend. He's going to start it off $15.50 an hour. I want to remind the committee of that. But I don't mind keeping this alive today's deadline and working on it in the future sometime. I'll leave that up to Chell, vote with the chair. Whatever way he goes, he's got to come up with the money.
Mr. Kyer, just a quick question. If this was last year at the beginning of the biennium, how would we fill in that blank appropriation if this would have been last year? What would you have requested for?
Mr. Chairman and members, I don't know what we would have had last year. For this year, what we were estimating the outside amount, again, depending on exactly how much dead people had out there, was about 1.7%. And obviously, as those loans were forgiven, keep in mind that anybody hired after October 1st, 2007 would not have been eligible, at least if you're full-time, because they could have advantage of the federal loan forgiveness, at least that's the way we structured it.
$1.6 million. And then I'm assuming that each biennial session you come in for another 1.6, would it keep going up, or what would it?
Mr. Chairman, the way we had looked at it is that it started out at the 1.6. As obviously, as you got into the program, if some debt was retired, obviously you might have folks coming in with additional debt, but there was a cap on the amount that we were willing to pay every year toward somebody's debt. So it wouldn't have gone beyond that. When you only had a certain amount of money, that was it. So.
Mr. Chairman, very, very
briefly.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kyer, I find it interesting that you have a number in light of the previous comment to me that you didn't think you had the authority to look at this. It sounds like the board has given it some thought, and I have a concern about what we're setting up here, and I'll leave it at that.
Oh, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, again, Chairman Representative Cole, we did have a supplemental budget request into the governor way back last fall for this program. And I think, you know, for us to come forward and say, gee, we'd really like to do it, we want the money, but then not have a number for you, I think probably would have been irresponsible on our part. We also recognize that since late last summer, the economic situation has changed a great deal. So we understand.
Representative Atkins, what would you like us to do? I share Representative Cole's and others' concerns about this, but I'm, if you would like to move this forward, or you can lay it over on the table, I just want to leave that up to you.
Sure, I'd appreciate the ability to move forward, quite frankly, I'm very open-minded to continue to work with the concerns that have been raised from Martin Zanavola and others. I think it was a great idea for the making process to work better, but it's obviously still a work in progress, and fully expect and will be fine with working with others in the future.
All right, then the chair will renew the motion that the House File 3876 be as amended. We recommend the pass and return to finance with a recommendation for re-referral to the General Register. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor?
Mr. Chair, wouldn't it be more appropriate to table the bill, make the fixes on it, and do that in here, and recommend it to the floor after we know what the bill is going to look like? I mean, I'm a little uncomfortable moving this to the floor, sure, even the way it is with the concerns that we have on the table.
Sure, that would be the chair's preference, and Representative Eason and others, we're prepared to add four county attorneys, which seems to be the one thing that came up again and again. And that will give the committee a little bit more. We obviously are not going to ever have a number. We don't have any money. That's why we took the appropriation out. But, and I know that some of the concerns that Representative Cole and others are trickling around the figure. But if it's a matter of we want to have it be fair for both sides, and the county attorneys be in there, I'm perfectly comfortable with that. And I think we can do that right now. It's very easy to do.
I think it's more complex than that. I think the discussion around the table here has a number of concerns that people have brought up that are go beyond just adding one little small segment. I think a bit broader discussion of this issue, as it affects all public employees and everything else, is important that we have, and so what goes out of here is something that we know we can support.
Mr. Chair, then why don't we lay it over? We'll be back at your discretion.
So,
there
will
be a short period of time.
Okay, so the chair will lay the bill over. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I guess you
did not ruin your reputation.
Representative Clark. For those of you who are here for House File 3132, we're still trying to decide. Representative Mulery apparently is not here, but we're trying to decide if. Ready? So we'll hear that bill. We also are going to hear from representatives from the county about the impact of the governor's budget on counties. Okay, Representative Clark, welcome to the committee. The chair will move House File 3196 for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Finance Supplemental Budget Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do have an amendment that modifies the bill, and if you could put it on, it's just in the form that I'd like the bill to be considered today. And it's listed as H3196A1, so it's the A1 amendment.
The chair then will move the... Chair will move the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I have an A1. Oh, I had a 1227.
And okay, and on the A1 amendment, delete on line 1, page 1, line 11, it should say topic rather than topics. It should be the correct language. Now, does everyone have the amendment? Is there any discussion on the A1 amendment? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Motion prevails. President Clark, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I really appreciate the chance to have this hearing today. What we're going to do is give you some information about what is a very serious problem, especially in the American Indian community, for the sexual exploitation of women and girls. And what we're doing with this bill is basically to help a nonprofit organization that's expertise in the area to do some culture-based research and help us all understand more what's going on with the prostitution of young Indian women and girls. And the additional thing in the amendment that you'll see is that we are asking that group that would be the recipient of the grant, and the grant is there's no new appropriation in this bill. The grant will be coming from existing fees that are assessed on basically the pimps and the John, is what I wanted to say. Thank you. and that's an existing law, just to put this group in mind to get some funding to do some research and actually to help us all understand what's really going on in this community. Some pretty serious things that have not, I think, come to the public's attention very much in the past. And we also say that there would be some training that this group would do to help our judges and attorneys and prosecutors understand that they should be enforcing the law that requires a fee to be assessed to those people who are in that business. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd like to actually turn the podium over to Suzanne Koblinger, who's with that nonprofit organization that I think would be the recipient of this grant, and I'd like her to talk a little bit about what the actual situation is and how we're going and what we've been doing with this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Suzanne Koblinger. I'm the executive director at the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center. Prostitution is not a victimless crime. We see large numbers of American Indian girls, some of them are children as young as 10 or 11 years old, and women who are being forced, sometimes forced, but the use of force, fraud, and coercion to sexually exploit these girls is a huge problem in our state and is not being recognized. We believe this is a statewide public health and public safety issue and that we have an obligation to begin to address it. The bill asks for statute change. We're simply asking that the Department of Public Safety continue to do research, particularly in the American Indian community, on the forced fraud and coercion into the sexual exploitation of American Indian girls and women. So funding is very important for us to begin to get accurate data on the scope of the problem. This will enable us to begin to create prevention, intervention, and prosecutorial strategies in partnership with the state law enforcement, tribes, counties, everyone who is being faced with this problem. We think that we're the right partners to do this work and that we'll get accurate and reliable data that can help us create some systems interventions that will be a cost saving. In fact, the trauma that most of these girls experience as a result of sexual exploitation results in higher costs to the system through judicial interventions, child protection system interventions, through increased costs through chemical dependency and mental health interventions, homelessness, and the list goes on and on. So we're actually presenting, I think, a long-term cost saving to the legislature that we can save in human trauma and human lives and also cost to the system. And I'd like to defer to my colleagues to address the issue of prostitution further.
Thank you for your testimony.
Hello, and I also want to thank you for here and giving us this opportunity. My name is Christine Stark, and I'm an author, a speaker. I've been working on issues of prostitution for 18 years now. And I'm also a member of the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. Prostitution, as Suzanne said, is violence against women and youth. And we talk about it as sexual exploitation, and she outlined some of the costs to the system and to the state, and then obviously to the community and the individuals and those who are being hurt in these ways. The importance of the research and the continuing education for us to be able to understand the full scope and gather the information that we need in order to address these issues and help the people being used and prosecute the people who are using the prostituted women and youth. some research that has already been done in five counties, or excuse me, five different countries by Melissa Farley and others show that 89% of prostituted women have been or are currently homeless, that 90% were abused as children. The average age of entry in the United States into prostitution is 13 years old. Prostituted women have higher post-traumatic stress disorder rates than war veterans. They have extremely high rates of rape and battery. And they incur numerous assaults daily. They can go from having to, as we shall say, service the men from five anywhere to 20 or more times a day. And one of the most interesting statistics that came from this research says that 89% of the prostituted people that were talked with said that they want to get out of prostitution immediately. So the research is incredibly important, not only for the reasons we've already outlined, but also to address the myths that many people in our society believe about prostitution, which makes it very difficult for us to effectively combat it. I want to give you just a little bit of anecdotal evidence, which again is one of the reasons why we need this research, because right now we have to rely on a lot of anecdotal evidence. A friend of mine was born up on White Earth and was adopted out, raised as a Greek girl. She didn't know that she was Native American until she was 27 years old. By that time, had already been extensively abused in the family that raised her, had gotten addicted to drugs, and ended up in prostitution, and spent basically her whole life struggling with overcoming the abuse that she suffered. Another friend of mine had a Native mother and a white father, was raised with the white family, and suffered an extensive amount of abuse within the family because she was part Native and was used in prostitution up until she was in her early 50s, and it was only at that time that she was finally able to get out. We also have anecdotal evidence from Duluth, where Native youth are being brought out onto the ships and prostituted. And also, as a former person who was working at Breaking Free, which you're probably familiar with here in St. Paul, we would see women coming in there, Native women coming in there, who had to get their faces completely restructured because so many bones in their faces had been broken. You know, another time a woman showed up on our steps and her pimp had followed her and had beaten her so badly that she was having a difficult time walking, and we had to take her immediately into the emergency room. Another story that I heard about from a woman down in the Franklin Avenue area, seeing a Native woman being kicked out of the car of a John who had just abused her, and he had just pulled out all of her fingernails and toenails. So given that American Indian women are abused at much higher rates than other racial groups, and that women of color are disproportionately used in prostitution, you know, we have this information, but we really need to get the money to do the research so that we can compile the evidence and move forward for the reasons Suzanne said, and also hopefully to provide services, culturally appropriate services, for Native women and youth involved in prostitution. Canada has done some surveys, and 62% of the women that they surveyed in the Vancouver area were First Nation women, in an area where 1 to 7% of the population is First Nation. In Winnipeg, they have done some research up there, and they have found that of the children involved in prostitution in Winnipeg, 89% of them were First Nation. So we have this information, but we need this research to get the numbers, and I want to thank you for your time, and hope that Minnesota can lead the way in doing this very important work.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Nicole Matthews. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. We're a statewide tribal coalition working to end violence against Native women in Minnesota. And we have begun taking on this issue, and in fact, hope to do some research on trafficking and prostitution of Native women and girls. A little background on who I am. I am an Anishinaabe woman from the White Earth Band of Ojibwe in northern Minnesota. I'm a mother, I'm a daughter, I'm a sister, I'm an auntie, I'm your neighbor, and I'm your constituent. I'm also, as I said, the executive director of the coalition, and I come before you today to ask that you support our vision, which is to provide safety and justice for Native women. And we do that through the teachings of our grandmothers, and our grandmothers tell us that all voices need to be heard, and that is precisely what we would like to do with this research. You see, we believe that no women, nobody in our society are throwaways, and oftentimes that's how women, prostituted women, are viewed. These are the ones that we often blame social perils and problems on, and ones that we say chose this life for themselves. How absurd it is to think that these women, who oftentimes were sexually abused as children, who sometimes were in out-of-home placement and were abused at the hands of someone other than their parents, who were then prostituted at the age of 13, which, by the way, is the average age of entry into prostitution, somehow at age 18 have chosen this life for themselves. I think about when I look at my 15-year-old daughter, who, like many 15-year-olds, she loves to go to the mall and hang out, and we know that's a prime place, a pickup place for a pimp. And I think about her being solicited, you know, God forbid, by a pimp, or taken out onto the street and prostituted. Would you look her in her eyes at age 18 and say, you chose this life? I don't think so. None of us would, because we have a heart and we care. And I know that all of you care. And I know you all have women and girls in your lives, and we're asking you, we're urging you to support this issue, that the First Nations women of this state are important. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Anything else, Representative Clark? We have some questions.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, I don't believe we deleted in the A1 amendment the dollar sign dot dot dot. So what is the appropriation that we're going to be talking about here?
Chairman,
we don't have a number at this point, Mr. Chairman. I believe this will be going forward into the finance committee. What we do know is that the if I'm not correct, they should be telling that.
We're going to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in our supplemental budget.
Okay, that's right. I can't do this as a finance committee issue there. But what I can tell you is that what we're asking for here only is what would be coming through the fees that are levied supposedly on the pimps and the guns. And at this point, it's such a tiny amount. We know that that's going to really be very much to begin with. I think we heard, we checked today and it was $100 in the fund. But what we're interested in doing is through the second part of the amendment where it talks about the grant recipient shall prepare and present a continuing legal education course to attorneys with a target audience of prosecutors and judges on the topic of prosecution. We're hoping that the judges will actually start levying that fee and fine, and we'll start to get some funds in there that in the future will be the source for this grant work. In the meantime, I think I could turn it over to Ms. Kobler, but I know they're going to try to raise private funds to begin right away, and in the future then, I'm not sure that what the dollar sign should be to ask your question most directly, because it's such a small amount anyway right now.
We are going to continue to try and
raise. Okay. But you have to go through the chair. Ms. Copeland.
Sorry.
We're taping this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are going to continue to raise private funds for this. We have a small amount of money already that the Minnesota Indian Women Sexual Assault Coalition has to begin to design the questionnaires and some of the interview methodologies that we're going to need. The more money we have, the more accurate and complete our research will be. We specifically do not want to take any of these funds away from existing service delivery programs like Breaking Free that are already doing very important work helping women get out of prostitution. So I guess I'm going to say we'll take what we can get and we'll do the best we can with what we have.
Mr. Chairman, maybe a question first to Carter. If there were penalties assessed under 609-3241, where would those penalties go? Would they go to the state general fund?
Mr. Cole, I believe it goes to the criminal crime victims, the OJP, doesn't it? But in Office of Justice Program, general crime victims account, that's where the money, yeah, that's where the money goes and where the grants are. That's what the grants are appropriated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a final question for now, probably for the first witness now. Sorry, I mean, Ms. Keplinger, or maybe for Representative Clark, how many organizations meet the grant qualification? In other words, is there more than one organization that can compete for this grant?
There are two.
Wait. Ms. Keplinger.
I'm so sorry. There are two, and they're both sitting right here at this table. The Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center and the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition are the two organizations that meet those requirements, and we are partners in this endeavor.
That's cool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just note that I've taken an interest over the last 3 or 4 months. I've been looking a little bit at grants to nonprofits, not just in the area of public safety, but across the board. And I've taken a look. I took a look again at the Legislative Auditor's report from a couple of years ago on grants, and I have some concerns about the way in which we make grants as a state. I know that there was some legislation that Representative Paulson, I believe, moved forward last year to create an Office of Grant Management, or whatever we're calling it. But that only takes a look, I believe, at grants over $25,000, and I have some concern about the amount of money that is collected from taxpayers in some cases, or you know, in this case, it's from Tim and John. I don't have a problem taking money from them, but it gets then passed through to nonprofit organizations, sometimes with you know, good, rigorous oversight by the agencies, and sometimes not, which is what the legislative auditor found. So I'm going to be done here, other than to just note that general concern. I'll look forward to some discussions if I'm unlucky enough to get reelected and come back here next year when we talk about the budgeting issues generally. But I raise that concern. There's a lot of legislation that we're passing that targets one or sometimes two groups who are in a partnership, and I mean, this is an earmark. It's what it is. Let's call it what it is, and it may be for a very good reason. I'm not debating that, but we're losing or at least potentially limiting other organizations. Maybe there's somebody at the U who could provide this kind of research. I don't know, but I make that comment, Mr. Chair, and I'll look forward to chatting about that further when we really deal with the budget again next year.
Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Clark, and I'm going to look at this as a term, page 212, and we have two organizations that fit the line of descriptors necessary to really narrow this in. But then on line 2 of page 2, you force the commissioner to pick one or the other. Unfortunately, because you say that the commissioner must apply a grant to a nonprofit organization. Right? So you're really forcing the commissioner's hand here. Representative Clark, my question to you is, why couldn't we shorten the bill, shorten the words in statute, get rid of the 10 lines of descriptors from 2.4 all the way down to 2.14 and just name the organization you want to get this grant?
Representative Diskins, I'll have Representative Clark, but this was exactly what Representative Coles was getting at. She's trying not to do that. Representative Clark, I should let you respond.
Sure. Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, one of the purposes of our statute is to really spell out how we would like things to be done. And I think the work that needs to be done here needs to be done by someone who really understands the issues. If there are other organizations who can bring some of those qualities to the research, that would be great. In fact, I wish there were much more. But right now, I'm only aware of two. It doesn't mean there aren't others out there. And what I think we really want to do is have those individuals who have been
aware of this issue. I mean, most, I think, I would say probably most people in this room may not be aware of the extent of the problem that we're bringing before you. I know I wasn't aware of the, of some of the things that are going on, especially with young women being, flipped off the reservations and taken over to the Shreveport in Duluth. This is a real, real problem. And we need people who are culturally aware and sensitive and have the skills and the ability to talk with these folks and not, you know, scare them away and actually help them get the services they need. So I guess I think it's really important that we have some expertise that's brought to bear here. And I think, especially in terms of our work also with the law enforcement, we want to make sure that there's, you know, again, expertise brought to bear. So I think what you're suggesting, it doesn't stop us from doing, I guess, what we would need to do. We would hope this would go to an organization that would have these entities. But I would really like to preserve this language because I think it helps us really understand what we're trying to do. Chairman, so that would be my request, that we keep the language. It helps us be very clear about what the goal of the
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wouldn't, I'm not sure. But I do think one of the issues with the language that's there, coupled with the purpose of the grant, which is to create research, throws doubt in people's minds, because the hallmark of research is its scientific validity. And if the organization doing the research is to come out, the organization has the background that you risk here, right? And the research is on the topic that you risk here. I think there would be great concerns by anyone looking objectively at this that we are being scientific about research.
Ms. Keplinger, briefly, we've got three other questions, and I want to remind the committee that we are laying the bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to respond. I acknowledge that there are concerns about evidence-based practices and research, but I would concur with Representative Clark that the critical issue here is the accuracy of the data is dependent upon who's asking the questions. In American Indian communities, this will give us the truth. And we're open to working with other partners. We're certainly open to working with the university if there's some expertise that they can bring to bear, although there's no additional funding for that. But we're happy to have additional scientists and researchers. But we both, I think both these organizations have a strong background in conducting research and have very valid evidence-based outcomes in their work.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a couple of questions. First, to both Ms. Keplinger and Ms. Matthews, what is the budget, the total budget of your organization that you represent here, and where does the most of that revenue come from currently? Yeah.
Ms. Matthews.
Again, my organization is the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. We currently have a $350,000 annual budget, which is funded solely by VAWA money through the federal government. Federal Violence Against Women Act grant.
Okay, and what about Ms. Keplinger?
Ms. Keplinger?
The Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center has an annual budget of $2.4 million. We are funded. About 48% of our budget comes from state and county grants. We also have funding from private sources, a lot of foundation grants. The Shakopee-Wahkatchin tribe funds us, and United Way funds us, and we have a lot of individual donors that fund us. We have a fairly diverse funding base.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, what would be the expected cost of this proposal if it was just approved and funded at a level that was going to work?
Ms. Kaplinger.
We estimate to do the job accurately and thoroughly, about $175,000. But as I mentioned earlier, we will do as much research as we can with the funds that we are able to allocate to this project.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I guess my only comment is, this is a huge issue. I mean, I don't think anybody's denying that this is a huge issue. Ms. Kaplinger, I think you mentioned that there was funding, that was some funding coming from the tribes, and I guess that would be my concern, is that this is a concern that I think should really involve, you know, the entire state, and I think the Native American community is a lot at stake here, and it's very important, and I think this should be a big part of the funding of this issue, and $175,000 doesn't seem like a lot of money when you look at what some of the casinos that are in our state raise. So I mean, I just think there's some other sources of money than just state government, and it would be I think it would be worth our time to pursue those as well, because this is an issue that affects all of us and affects Native Americans more than anyone. And if there's some ways that they could contribute to this, I think it would be beneficial for all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to speak for the record briefly in light of Nick Nance's comments about the earmarking issue. I'd like to go down in the history of this place as a pro-earmark legislator. I think there's a philosophical difference between a lot of people on this, especially in light of what's going on at the federal level right now, and I think it's fully appropriate for people to come in here and say this is what we need the money for and have the accountability lie with elected representatives. And if we're going to outsource it to bureaucrats, that's okay. Sometimes it's appropriate. But I really like to be able to consider the individual merits of a program like we are. And sometimes I think the subject of the report from the legislative auditor and the concerns of the polls are well-founded in that it's looked at as preferential treatment. However, I just wanted to say that for the record briefly, Mr. Chair, I think it's entirely appropriate.
Representative Cornish. Mr. Chair, members, just by a comment, I have not a big problem with the money, but I support the other part of the bill. I think I've been on almost every Indian reservation and seeing they're not all like Mystic Lake. When you get to White Earth and you get to Red Lake and you get to Ned Lake and some of those northern reservations, the conditions that they suffer under would not be a surprise that somehow a poor young woman would have been turned to prostitution. And I think that nobody probably knows American Indian women's problems like American Indian women, and so I don't have any problem with the language in this bill. The only problem that I would have would be competing with my request for the treatment center garden. No, but I really approve of your policy. Only competition is for money. I think you know what you're doing here. And the Indian community has got lots of scientists, biologists that run everything from natural resources to government, so I think you can do it.
I just want to thank you very much for that statement, Representative Cornish. And I would remind folks that the source of this funding are the pimps and the dogs. Not coming from any place else. That's what we're requesting in this bill. So you want to call it state government, I don't know, I guess you can, but it goes through state government channels, but I don't think it's
Minnesota, not New York.
Chair, I just want to thank you. I hope one of the functions of today's meeting was just to highlight the issues, and I thank you, Representative Cornish. I think you really helped make that clear. This has not been discussed very much. Difficult issue, and we're happy to hear
it. Representative Clark, thank you for bringing the bill forward, and thank you all for your testimony. The chair will lay over House File 3196 for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Finance Supplemental Budget Bill. Thank you all very much. Okay, now I need to ask a question of the committee, because we have a problem with House File 3132. Representative Mallory is not here, and we don't know where he is. Representative Bigham, who is a co-author of the bill, is at the Capitol on another matter. And I've asked Mr. Gribble and Mr. Carter, whether it's okay for someone else to present the bill, but I won't do that if there's any objections to it. Representative Lesh has offered to present it. But if there's anyone who objects to that, we will lay the bill over and he'll hear the bill next week.
Mr. Chair, who are the authors on the bill?
Representative Moore and Bigham, as far as
I would say, without an author, I would be very uncomfortable hearing the bill, quite frankly.
Very good. She's not here.
Representative Mohan. Mr. Leskin, Mr. Leskin. When can
you
sign up as co-author? Can
you
sign up as co-author?
Everybody sign up.
Did you have a proposal?
There's not a deadline issue with it,
no?
Is there?
No. We had some people in the audience. I thought, in respect to them, we wanted to hear it, but unfortunately, we won't hear it. I don't want to.
Mr. Chair, do you want to take some testimony before we lay the bill over?
Well, that's a good idea.
Mr. Chair, and then we can lay the bill over.
Great minds are on. Why don't we do that? So I'm not going to move. I'm not going to move the bill, but we're going to hear testimony, and then we will be fully informed and ready to vote on it on Monday or Tuesday, whenever we hear this.
Maybe some brief testimony.
Yes, some brief testimony. I think people understand what this bill is. It's let the witness explain the bill briefly.
Sure, thank you, Nancy Hillman, on behalf of Humane Society. Just quickly to tell you that this bill was unopposed in the policy committee, judiciary committee, public safety committee, sorry. And we have two people to testify, and I have a handout that Mr. Trupp might have to review.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Keith Streff, and I'm the senior investigator for the Animal Humane Society based in Golden Valley. And I have quite a bit of involvement in this bill over the years with Representative Mullery, and I've worked on with him on a number of occasions and language and tweaking this bill to better affect the enforcement practices and application of the language in its current form. Just a basic overview, the intent of the bill is largely to clean up the language and amend some of the existing applications of the language that as it currently exists. It's a very simple scenario. It's going to, it's basically a reaction to the Michael Vick scenario where dogfighting was brought into the nation's homes as a pastime and recreation of brutalizing dogs for the pure sport of entertainment and money. And from the photos that you see here, in the 21 years that I've been working in this industry, these are individual photographs of paraphernalia and animals that I've seized in dogfighting cases in the past. And currently, this little language does not allow us to charge and or arrest for the possession of fighting paraphernalia and other equipment used in the engagement of actually fighting dogs. And if you read it, it's a simple amendment that in one of my other lives as a police officer is corollary to the drug paraphernalia. Whereas now if we come across this paraphernalia in individual homes in Minnesota, it's not currently a crime at a gross misdemeanor level. So if we can deter the purchase of a ticket and we can deter the possession of equipment and other paraphernalia to actively train and engage dogs to fight, perhaps that'll be a deterrent to fighting dogs overall, which is our general objective. So I'll be happy to answer questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Justice. So just to be clear what we're doing here, if a person purchased a ticket to a dog fight, they would be they could be charged. They'd be guilty of a gross misdemeanor instead of a misdemeanor. Is that the?
That is correct. Currently, it's a misdemeanor, and in my experience over the years in investigating these cases, the great majority of those participants at a fight are present dog fighters and are watching the events unfold, and currently all we do is tab charge them or issue them citation and cut them loose. So the gross misdemeanor will make it a little bit more of a pinch in the event that they're caught attending a fight.
Would you like to provide some testimony?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jill Fritz. I'm the Minnesota State Director for the Humane Society of the United States. Mr. Chair, in a recent ranking of state dogfighting laws, Minnesota ranked 19th in the country because of weak penalties for knowing spectators at an animal fight. While we make animal fighting and possession of animals for fighting felony offenses, being a spectator, as we talked about, is only a misdemeanor. So what this bill would do, as you said, was make it a gross misdemeanor to be a spectator in an animal fight. And the reason for this is that in an organized animal fight, there are often several rounds during an event, and many spectators at one round are there to participate as animal fighters in another round. So when law enforcement officials raid an animal fight, it's difficult to determine who's a participant and who's not. So with weaker spectator penalties, there's a loophole in the law that allows them to be charged with weaker penalties. Spectators basically finance the organization and promotion of animal fights. The primary motivation for animal fighting is financial. Spectators pay admission as high as $100 per person in some cases. And they also gamble on animal fights, sometimes thousands of dollars in one fight. So without that spectator element, organized animal fighting would not flourish. And so we need a law that reflects that. Those who attend dog fights are accomplices at, and cockfighting, an accomplice at enabling illegal activity. And as a participant myself in the largest bust of a cockfighting operation in U.S. history in California last fall, I witnessed firsthand evidence of this. And in a recent raid we did on a dogfighting operation in Arizona last month, at least 150 dogs were seized along with $10,000 in cash and more than 60 firearms, from revolvers to assault-type weapons. So there's clearly a connection with other crimes, too, in animal fighting. So we feel it's very important to have stronger penalties to attend animal fights and be at them in the existing law, and also give prosecutors leverage to coerce spectators to testify against animal fighting participants. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. How prevalent are these kind of activities in Minnesota? I mean, do we have some kind of documentation, and has it increased or decreased, or is it a stable number? Or give us some idea about the history and where we are kind of in this issue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's very difficult to put a finger on any illegal or covert activity, specifically dogfighting, because of the nature of the cottage industry of which it operates, much like that of prostitution or any other covert activity. You can't go to a resource and answer the question how much there is. I can tell you from 21 years in the industry, pretty good job security and chasing it around town. I think any large metropolitan city has a pretty significant amount of activity and underground activity, whether it be in training, breeding, buying and selling, or the actual engagement of the dogfighting itself. I typically get a call or a complaint or information about dogfighting on a weekly basis. It's an ongoing investigation that you work your confidential informants, and you play it constantly. And I probably do physical interventions on somewhere in the vicinity of half a dozen to 10 actual dogfighting cases a year in the state of Minnesota. That's just my agency.
How many people get arrested or prosecuted to have some consequences because of this? I guess my question is kind of going to the issue is just changing the consequences going to change the fact that we're chasing people around, or are we actually going to catch people, and are they actually going to receive stiffer consequences? Are we catching anybody now that were actually having consequences because they were after posting one of these things?
Mr. Chair, this is what's going to increase that. Currently, if we catch anybody in the attendance of a dogfight now, it's a tab charge, you wouldn't know any difference. It's equal to a speeding ticket, and they cut loose. So this all works towards that goal, is to hold more of these individuals accountable that are actively participating in it. Currently, it's at a misdemeanor level. It's profitable to be in the business. As the Vic case has unfolded, there's tens of thousands of dollars at hand here to actively participate in a particular sport. Making it a gross misdemeanor now is going to make that more of a deterrent, at least in our opinion. But those individuals that we do catch, we have to catch in the act. What this bill is doing now is increasing the penalty just to be attending or to be in the possession of paraphernalia. So prior to that, we had to catch somebody in the act, which is a much harder and more significant standard of intervention.
Just one final question. I mean, we said we're 19th. We have the 19th weakest. I don't know if that means we have the 31st strongest, or how where that would put us. But my question is there good evidence that if we increase the strength of our law here and our penalties, that the amount of this activity will decrease. Is there evidence of that in other states? Do they have less of it than we have because they have higher penalties? Ms. Smith.
Thank you. I don't have that information in front of me, but I can find out for you evidence of when penalties have increased for being spectators and having paraphernalia, if there have been increased arrests and convictions.
Or decreases in the amount of activity. Now, I think that would be good information to have when we go to the bill.
I will find that out for you.
We'll be taking the bill up again on Wednesday, so maybe you could provide that, Representative Lesh.
Thank you. The officer, and I think I just answered my first question by perusing it more fully, but I may clarify it later. You stated that currently it's what you call a cab charge or equivalent of a speeding ticket, which in Minnesota is a petty misdemeanor. My understanding is that currently it's a misdemeanor with a maximum penalty of 90 days and a $1,000 fine. Which is it that you charge people with?
Representative Lesh, it's been my experience that the tab charge would be a misdemeanor, but it's largely pled out as a petty misdemeanor. The largest case that I was involved with was in Chisago County, I believe in 2005, and there were 57 some arrests, and they were all issued citations at the spot and released. We're discovering those individuals in subsequent fights all over the metro, and it's obviously no deterrent, whereas I believe if we could hold them as a gross misdemeanor, the subsequent penalty and stigma attached with attending a fight is going to get out to that particular market.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is, you know, I think of this in terms of theft too, or shoplifting, which is frequently put out to as, well, not necessarily petty misdemeanors, because we do have some time hanging, but if you routinely just take misdemeanors and the prosecutors are turning them into petty misdemeanors by giving a payable fine, no probationary time hanging over their head for a year, I'm wondering if maybe the solution on this, why can't it be giving more time or encouraging the prosecutors to push for more time on misdemeanors, encouraging the judges, educate the judges to say, hey, you know, this is bad. Why don't you start giving jail time for this? And I use this, for example, with shoplifting. We routinely aren't going to put people in jail until we see a pattern and they're doing it professionally. It's not just picking things here and there. And then we start giving jail time, 30 days, 60 days. Why isn't that an option rather than just turning into a growth?
Mr. Scott?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, it feels gray here. A lot of portion of my time is spent asking that question and lobbying that effort in prosecutor's office and law enforcement agencies across the state, and I don't have an answer to that question. Second part, this particular bill also allows to charge out individuals that are caught in possession of paraphernalia holding it. So the it's just a simple one-word amendment to the bill where it's adding a gross misdemeanor to the offense of attending one. I think in my particular role as an investigator, the more important part of this bill is being able to seize animals and charge individuals with participating in dogfighting activities when they're in possession of paraphernalia and other materials used in the performance of a dogfight.
And Mr. Chair, can I just thank you. The reason I ask this question is because when we turn things from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor, which is a popular get tough on crime tactic for many legislators, it doesn't necessarily have a fiscal note attached to it because there's no felony state prison bedtime attached to it. But there is a substantial local impact. We're not tagging out more for misdemeanors now. We're drafting probable cause statements and submitting it through, having the judge sign off on it, having the cop sign off on it, having the prosecutor sign off and sending it through. They get additional time with respect to bail. You get higher bail for it. And sometimes I think, you know, we're using a shotgun to kill a mosquito, so to speak. And that's why I asked the question. I'm not opposing it at all, but I try to ask this question when we're turning this into gross misdemeanors, because I think it's an important cost factor that we don't consider around here in the local soak it up.
Is it Representative Clinch?
The officer just because you only catch them when you're doesn't mean that that's all the fighting that's going on, right? I mean, some of these dog fighters, maybe if they hear about the increased penalties and the paraphernalia and things like that, we could be prohibiting some of the things that we're never going to catch. I mean, it's going to be a spin-off effect that's beneficial for this legislation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I agree 100% that there's an interesting law enforcement corollary in that there's a deterrent in knowing that if it's, most times it all comes down to cost-benefit analysis. Those individuals that are participating or attending these particular fights is the fuel that's providing the demand for continuing fighting. So if you can't sell a ticket, and you can't sell a ticket because there's less people going in to attend that particular fight, that makes less demand for the fighter, and all the prices come down. It's just a cause and effect a process that we want to pursue. The other aspect of that is to address Representative Rush, is that I think the increased penalties and the progression towards law enforcement and the focus of the importance of this particular bill is going to be more consistent with other states.
Very good, thank you. Is that cool?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very briefly, just two quick comments since we're not acting on the bill. I guess I ask maybe Mr. Diebel, I'm not sure if line 1.17, that should, when we start the new sentence, that should be a new paragraph. It just doesn't seem to read right to me. We have 1 through 5 that end with a gross offense, and then that same paragraph we've included the felony. I just raised the issue. It doesn't read right to me, but maybe I'm mistaken. The other question I would have, if the witness could answer briefly, the concern I have about the paraphernalia language is that I don't really know what device or substance intended to enhance an animal's ability to fight is. I would be more comfortable with the language if we had the intention requirement, if they intended to use that device for the purpose of dogfighting. That may be what you're trying to get at here, but if somebody's got a stick and they beat the dog, everybody who's got a stick then is potentially guilty of a gross misdemeanor. And I want to give you the authority, the ability to go after people who have these things and they're using them for the purpose of training animals to fight. But I don't want to, I don't want to cast too broad of a net and scoop somebody up who maybe we shouldn't. So if you could address that briefly, and then we can deal with this next week.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Smith,
I find it pretty difficult right now to make a significant impact or intervention in these inner cities or the larger communities that dogfighting is a prevalent problem in. And some of the paraphernalia and equipment that you see in the photos ahead of you is pretty significant evidence that suggests there's a dogfighting activity going on. And normally that paraphernalia is going to be accompanied by a dog that is showing a pretty consistent pattern of being aggressive, dangerous, and also active in dogfighting. So that, I don't think there's any single piece of evidence or paraphernalia that we would use unless there's some other type of aggravating value, such as a complaint of dogfighting activity or other criminal activities in the home, pit bulls or other pit bull breed mixes or other dogs that are consistently involved with dogfighting and also are showing significant evidence of significant or intrinsic injuries that are not consistent with your typical dog fighting for aggression or for hierarchy. The wounds and the injuries are much more significant than is depicted in those photos.
Yeah. Is there anyone from the audience that would like to speak in favor of the bill or in opposition to the bill? Well, thank you both for your testimony. We'll hear this bill hopefully on at our next meeting on Wednesday. The final item on our agenda, we're going to hear from the Metropolitan Inter County Association, the Association of Minnesota Counties, Mr. Keith Carlson. Sorry for a long day here. I didn't expect these bills to take quite so long. We have heard from a number of agencies under the auspices of this committee about the impact to them relative to the governor's recommendations for his supplemental budget. So we'd just like you to let us
let us know what the impact might be on the counties if we were to accept his recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson, and I do have a correction. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. We changed our name about a year ago because 8 of our 13 members are actually from Greater Minnesota. I do want to make clear today that in my role as a representative of those counties, that I'm really sharing with you the perspective of the county board, the entities that actually pay for the services provided by the counties, and do not specifically represent the concerns of the independently elected sheriff or county attorneys, but I will try and capture what I would believe would be their concerns as best I can. I think you were looking for observations on the impact of the governor's supplemental budget recommendations in the public safety area. I will only touch on a few of those that I think have greatest impact on counties, and would be happy to answer questions, or my colleague would also, I'm sure, be happy to do the same. Before I get to the specifics of the governor's impact, I do want to make the committee aware that we are a very large piece of the portion of the correction system that deals with the sanctions imposed on criminals in Minnesota. I think, as the committee knows, there are about 9,200 prisoners in state institutions right now. There are over 142,000 individuals out on probation in Minnesota, the other part of the system, and the lion's share of those are served by county employees, not by employees of the state. As the result of our efforts, the efforts, frankly, by you and the administration, and setting up the current system, Minnesota enjoys one of the lowest prisoner per capita rates in the nation without really sacrificing public safety. We pay about one-third, we imprison about one-third the number of prisoners that our neighbor Wisconsin does, with no discernible difference in the crime rate. On the third page of the document that I've provided you, presentation of the House Public Safety Finance Commission, you'll see sort of a recitation of the appropriations trends for several of the components of the corrections public safety system. And I want to use those to sort of couch my comments that frankly, we're grateful that some of the dollars that we received from the state were not affected by the governor. In the area of community services, for frankly the first time in this decade, we finally saw an increase in funding that brought us back to, after adjusting for the short-term offenders, to the level of funding that we were receiving back in fiscal year 2003. So we're very happy that the governor has not suggested making changes in the Community Corrections Act funding, CPO funding, or the funding for DOC probation officers. But it probably shouldn't be any surprise to you, we are obviously disappointed that the short-term offenders increase that was just passed last session will be undone if you enact the governor's recommendation. I think, as you know, back in 2003, the state started sending offenders with less than 6 months to serve to county for placement in our county jails and other detention facilities. Originally, we were led to believe that this would affect about 200 or so offenders a year. But the reality is that it's been running nearly 50% greater than that right now at about 319 a year, and it is having substantial costs on us that is affecting what we have to pay and what ultimately our property taxpayers have to pay. So I certainly want to make you aware of the adverse effects on the counties of that change. In the area of the sentence served program, The government, that's the other cutback that is proposed by the governor in this area. I think as the members know, this is an alternative sentencing scheme to traditional either jail sentences and or probation. And it's basically historically 50% locally funded and 50% state funded. About 85% of the state currently provides these programs. And any of you on probably any weekend will be driving down a highway and will see a crew of orange vest individuals picking up trash along the highway. This isn't the only example of sentence to serve, but it is a common one. And, you know, obviously we have a concern with anything that reduces this alternative to traditional corrections practices. I'll just mention then with regards to the district court funding, as the members know, the state is responsible for the administration of the courts as the result of the completion of the state takeover a few years ago. But the facilities are still funded by us and are basically common with our county offices. And frankly, the citizens don't make the distinction. I think as you all know, the courts are suffering already under the funding levels that they have right now and have been cutting back hours or services to deal with that. And it becomes a customer service issue as much for us as it does for them because, again, people don't make the distinction between the courts and the rest of county government. It's also obviously an issue in terms of how quickly we adjudicate the cases that are in the county attorney's venue. I'll voice a similar concern with regards to the reduction for the Public Defense Board. I think probably the members of the committee are as well versed as anybody that the system of justice, the wheels of that system, are greased by good representation for both the defense and the prosecution. And to the extent that increased caseloads hinder that, it slows down the system and we end up picking up the cost on the back end in terms of increased hold times at county jails. We're also particularly concerned about what effect this might have for representation for children in need of protected services. I think both organizations have consistently taken a stance that the public defenders are the appropriate counsel for indigents involved in these sort of suits because, for one, they're usually representing these individuals on the criminal side that are running a parallel track to this civil part of the issue. Again, it's a matter of quickly delivering justice in these areas. And we've always advocated for sufficient funding for the Public Defense Board to provide services in the area. Final thing that I'll touch on under the Public Safety Department is the proposed cutbacks in the CrimNet project area. Again, I think the sheriffs are probably better placed to comment on this, but my understanding of this is one of the areas where they're cutting back on is in the purchase of new automated fingerprint identification hardware. This is really sort of the guts or the front end of the process. For example, the individual who was the driver of the car that hit the bus out in Cottonwood, Minnesota, and caused the death of four people, she was using an assumed name. It was through fingerprints that she was ultimately identified who she was, and the unavailability of this equipment would certainly hinder the advancement of justice in those situations. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude and turn things over to my court colleague if he has any additional comments.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Ryan Erdman. In addition to being director of MACAC, the Community Corrections Act Counties Association, I'm also the public safety analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. In the interest of all your time, I won't add. I think Mr. Carlson, his comments reflect the opinions I would have reflected on behalf of AMC. We're right here by myself. But I did want to be here and let you all know that AMC does share the opinions that Mr. Carlson elaborated and to be here and available for questions that they might relate to counties that are not MECA members. So that's all I will add, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, the other day I heard a number from what the actual cost for keeping a prisoner might be, or a prisoner in a county jail, and that was given to us at $15. Does that sound like a pretty good number to you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merrill, there is certainly a range of costs, but 60 to 90, as high as $100 a day, depends on the county, the facility, and the caseload, particularly with the short-term offenders. For those counties that are at capacity, the upper end of that spectrum, or even beyond, is the number, because frequently, because they don't have beds in their own facilities, counties are having to lease the at other facilities. For example, Dakota County has housed some of its offenders as far away as Wilmer, Candy, Ohio County. So not only is it the cost of leasing the bed, it's the cost of transporting that individual to and from, and the time of that deputy who's making that transport that goes into those spots.
So you think that the 15 is probably a pretty extraneous number?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes.
Thank you. The CrimeNet elements in the fingerprinting process now, if I understand it, is a technology that's instant, and you can identify people very, very quickly that you have. It isn't something like on TV with a magnifying glass looking at fingerprints, but it's a pretty fast technology and pretty important to identifying the people that you have.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the bottom line is it is quick. It's basically creating an electronic digital image that can be shared with other entities, particularly the Federal Bureau of Investigation. That's the repository of this information nationally. That allows the quick turnaround that I think you're referring to.
Mr. Chair, question. If I remember mandates, some of the fingerprinting that is being done because of a state mandate. Not that you wouldn't want to do that.
Mr. President, Representative, you're exactly right. That there are additional mandates in that regard.
Okay. Anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, I know you were here during the last bill listening to it, as I voiced my concerns about yet another increase from misdemeanor to gross misdemeanor, and how it shows a goose egg on fiscal notes, and everyone around here thinks it's free. And of course, they're not free. We know who paid the cost of that. I'm very interested in your ideas as to how we may avoid that problem in the future by forcing more costs onto the locals without a commensurate increase in local government aid or whatever other kinds of funding sources we may have for that. Do you have any comments about that?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I mean, you're obviously dead on that any changes that increased criminal sanctions will have an adverse effect in terms of jail utilization and our cost for operating those facilities. Other than obviously not increasing the sanctions, the other alternatives are, for one, increased funding for sentence to serve, and other diversionary programs such as that. As long as those diversionary programs are potentially state-funded rather than locally funded. You know, probation obviously received extraordinarily high utilization in Minnesota, has an alternative sanction to imprisonment in state facilities. Again, you know, we're ready to step up and do that as long as adequate funding is provided, and quite frankly, in the last 6 years, until the action of this committee and ultimately the full legislature, we don't think that's been provided.
because the funding has actually went down from the 2002-2003 level before coming back up to basically where it was back then. Hopefully this committee and legislature will see fit to make sure that in the future continued commitment to that sort of funding will take place and the community alternative will continue to be a viable alternative for dealing with these increased criminal sanctions if that is the desire of the legislature.
No? Well, thank you both for your testimony. I appreciate it. There's no other business before the committee. We will be meeting Wednesday, at 8 o'clock, unless you hear different from us. But that's the plan. We'll hear a couple of more bills and hopefully take up the budget bill if we can get everything back.
I'd like to point out that this dog was the winner. So that's right.
Thank you.